Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you today. Great as always to have your company. In just a moment, we're going to hear our exclusive interview with Pakistan's finance minister on the financial reforms, a potential pain to come for ordinary Pakistanis after securing the final $1 billion of our latest funding round from the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. We'll explain all the machinations, how it works, and what it might mean next for businesses inside and outside the country. Also today, how a weakness in Japan's currency, the yen, globally, is impacting businesses at home.
We face these sort of challenges, mostly about daily charges like electricity or the goods, because as a company, we also purchase things from abroad. Right now, it's a bit more difficult.
Yeah, we'll talk through a little bit more of some of the potential financial winners and losers of what's going on with the yen. And we'll also be in Kenya, hearing from one of the country's oldest exporters about the impact already the devastating floods there are having on business and what it might mean in the long term in terms of the price of vegetables and other agricultural goods you may be getting in the supermarket wherever you live around the world. Remember, if you hear anything in the programme that you want to get in touch with us about, world.business@bbc.co.uk is the email. Let's kick off the programme, though, as we have done many times, talking about Pakistan and its financial troubles. At the weekend, the country secured its final slice, a pretty sizable one, a $1 billion one, in fact, of its latest $3 billion bailout programme from the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF, to try and stabilise the country's finances. The cash, though, once again comes with conditions, rules that Pakistan must meet around raising taxes and spending less. Can it do it after more than 20 previous promises and 20 previous goes that haven't been fulfilled? It's been a question many, even inside the country, have been asking, including the new finance minister, Mohammed Aurangzeb. He's been chatting exclusively to us here on World Business Report.
I think this was extremely important. This marked the successful conclusion of the nine-month SBA program. So it was good to see that the IMF board cleared the final tranche. It gives us the necessary credibility. It gives us that we can, as a country, show the necessary discipline that we can follow. But it allows us now to go into further discussions with IMF to go for a larger and a longer program. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is really twofold. One is that it will allow us to bring more permanence into the macroeconomic stability, which was ushered in by this nine-month SBA program. And the second aspect of it is it will allow us the necessary umbrella and the necessary time frame to execute the reform agenda as we go forward.
Execution seems to be a key element of it, didn't it? And the IMF, in their statement around this from the weekend, said the need to continue policy of reform, including strict adherence to fiscal targets. It's always difficult, isn't it? Especially you being a newish government. People, when they run departments, understandably, they get into politics to try and spend money and change people's lives and that kind of thing. It's going to have to be quite a lot of austerity, isn't there? Do you think everybody's on the same page in that terms of that?
You see, these things have to go hand in hand. You see, we have known the what and why for a very long time. Because if I tell you what are the key priorities around this reform agenda, the first is tax to GDP. Tax to GDP has been hovering below 10%. It's just not sustainable. We have to start taking it towards 13, 14%.
And what does that look like? Is that personal taxes? Is that taxes on companies? What is that?
Everything which is included, it will have two aspects to it. One, we have to fix the leakages which are there in the system. That's in the short term. And then we have to bring undertaxed, untaxed sectors within the net. We have to take our tax to GDP to a 15% range.
But tangibly, Minister, what does that look like? Is that persuasion? Is that enforcement? You know, give us some sort of concrete examples if you
can. It's a function of both enforcement, because those gaps are there. That's one. The other is, you know, we are going in for end-to-end digitalization of our tax authority. Because the moment you remove human intervention, and that will be over the next 12 to 18 months that we are able to do that, it will certainly help in our revenues. It will help the transparency, and it'll bring better client experience. Now, where you are sitting, you know that if you get a tax form, you find it's reliable, you find that your self-assessment is going to be respected. The only way it is going to happen here is if we digitalize the system and we take the human intervention out. So there's going to be short-term, medium-term, long-term steps which we are going to take. And the short-term stuff, which is enforcement, is already underway.
In the short term as well, it's going to mean financial pain for quite a lot of Pakistanis too, surely.
Well, you know, we have run out of taxing the same for more. Can we do it for another year? Can we do it for another 2 years? Yes, we can. But if we don't start by bringing under-taxed and untaxed sectors into the fold, as I keep on repeating myself, then we'll never get there. So our hand has been forced.
And
we have to move in that direction.
The other side of this is, of course, revenues and how you raise revenues, and particularly around exports, which is something I think for the entirety of my career at the World Service, successive Pakistani governments of all colours have said they're going to do more of. How do you break that cycle? How do you actually manage to make that a reality?
I would say if you see year on year, actually the revenues have gone up, and they have gone up quite significantly. The issue still remains that we have to bring off, you know, the fiscal discipline, which means more revenues. And we also have to manage our expenditures at the government level, which means greater fiscal discipline, which needs to be brought in. So it's going to be a function of both. But I think here we are sort of mixing a few things. One is sort of the taxation part on the revenue side and on the expenditure side. So that's the fiscal side. You know, the question that is always asked, why do you think this is going to be the last program? You know, we are in the 24th program that we are entering. And the only way we are going to get out is by a clear road to market, which means we have to increase our exports. There has to be foreign direct investment, and we have to improve our ratings so that we can access international capital markets. So it'll be a combination of the three, which we have to execute over the next 2 to 3 years so that we don't have to seek another program.
How do you incentivize that, I suppose? How do you juice up the private sector to help you do that?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question. Even during the next fiscal year, there are two sectors where we have a huge upside, which has nothing to do with any externality. It's our agriculture sector and it's our IT sector. We had another additional $1 billion of rice exports this fiscal year. Our agriculture GDP is growing at 5%. There's no reason why we can't continue to increase our crop yields and dairy and livestock yields, which is 50% of the country's agriculture GDP. This all in our control. The second one is IT. We have the third largest freelancer population in the world. This year, our IT exports are going to be, software exports are going to be $3.2 billion. A few years back, it was almost nothing. Nothing stops us from continuing to move in that direction. But there we will have to fix our energy equation, allow them to have competitive energy so that they continue to contribute on the export side.
Country drowning in government, drowning in government debt, and now you're saying to people, "Don't worry, we're going to put your taxes up too."
I would like to remind you of two things. We peaked the inflation peaked at 38%. Yes, it's now down to 20%. It's the state bank figure because it's the central bank which is managing both the interest rate and the foreign exchange, and their monetary policy is saying that we will get to 5 to 7% by September of next year. So we are certainly on a downward trajectory. Now let's come to your second point, asking people to do more and asking for more taxes. Yes, in those sectors which have not contributed yet. because the salaried class is where, they have been taxed and more taxes on the same. Similarly, on the industry side. So in terms of the sectors which have not contributed so far, we have to start moving in that direction. That's very important.
Do you not worry that some of those people might just decide to go somewhere else, somewhere that's a lower tax jurisdiction, that you lose some of those people on the way that you need?
I think talent hunt and talent acquisition, talent retention is a global discussion. We will do our level best to ensure that we balance the two, including, as I mentioned, if we don't do what we need to do in bringing these untaxed sectors, then it's actually the salaried class which will walk with their feet if they are continuing to be taxed the way they are being taxed today. And as I said, that optionality is always there. We tax the same for more. But that's sort of kicking can down the road. And if we will continue to be hovering around 10% tax to GDP, and that, as I keep on saying, is not sustainable.
A final thought, Minister. What about the debt? At a very high level, the government debt still, and obviously getting more, we're talking about a lot on the programme today with the strength of the US dollar, for example, that a lot of that debt is in, becomes more expensive to finance it. High interest rate world, been very expensive to finance it. Must keep you up at night, doesn't it? Make you pretty nervous having to try and deal with those repayments as the finance minister.
I think as far as the external debt is concerned, our profile as a country is very different from many other countries. Our commercial debt has actually been paid, but we have paid about $6 to $8 billion. We repaid the Eurobond, $1 billion, about 2 weeks back. The next payment is not due till $500 million till September of next year. The rest of our debt is bilaterals and multilaterals. So it's a very, very different profile of the debt.
But it's $130 billion. I mean, it's an extraordinary pile of debt.
No, but that's where I would correct you if you want to check your figures. It's now below $100 billion. And as I said, the commercial part of it is only 6 to 7%. And it's the balance, 80%, 85% is really multilateral and bilateral stuff. A lot of bilateral stuff has been rolled over, and we expect the same for the next fiscal year. As far as the local debt is concerned, listen, we are as a country, our debt to GDP is about 70%. Now there are many other countries which they have gone beyond 100%. This level of debt has to be brought down. The debt servicing locally, as the interest rate regime starts coming down, will start relieving the pressure on the exchequer as the policy rate moves down over a period of time in line with inflation. And that will bring our debt servicing cost as well. So as far as we're concerned, at this point in time, it is certainly a data point that we are keeping a very close eye on. This is not something which we worry too much about.
You raised it yourself, Minister, earlier, so I'll put your own point to you and a cliched point, as you pointed out. But what is your level of hope, belief, that this is the last round with the IMF, that this is the final programme, and that you crack this problem at the 20-odd time of answering?
Yeah, no worries. If we don't, that is the whole point, if we don't take the tough decisions, if we don't move forward with the structural reforms, we just talked about the tax aspect of it, but we need reforms on the energy side, we need reforms on the SOE side, and we need to accelerate the privatization agenda. On the privatization side, our national airline is being privatized as we speak. We are privatizing one of the larger airports at this point in time, and I'm very hopeful that by early July, we will see success at both. And then there are other loss-making SOEs which we need to privatize as we go forward. So these three areas are going to be critical, and the success around is going to be critical if we are not envisioning another program.
That's the Finance Minister of Pakistan, Mohammed Aurangzeb, speaking to us there. Russ Mould from the UK investment platform AJ Bell in the studio here with us today. Hi, Russ. Just explain again, we touched on it a little bit, but it's not unique to Pakistan. Whenever the IMF lends money out around the world, comes with conditions. It's always slightly more complicated than perhaps the headline cash looks like.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a free lunch or free money, unfortunately. And the price that the IMF usually demands is austerity in a simple word. It's usually higher taxes, it's usually lower government spending. You would guess I call it Western financial orthodoxy. I'm sure Pakistanis will look at this and think, really, when the European Union countries constantly rewrite their own rules? But nevertheless, that is usually the price that is demanded. Clearly, what Pakistan hopes is it doesn't need another programme and it can start to tap international financial markets in a less expensive, less painful way. That's the goal, but it's never an easy road, as we've discovered in Pakistan's history particularly.
Yeah, and hold that thought about the pain, because we're going to talk about the strength of the US dollar and what's that doing in lots of places around the world, but obviously also having an impact if you are repaying, say,
a dollar loan. And the dollar isn't your currency. It's enormously painful. And traditionally, a strong dollar is seen as very negative for emerging market economies and currencies and stock markets because of that borrowing situation.
Absolutely. More from Russ a little bit later in the programme. More from Arik Zeb as well on our podcast if you want to hear that. Let's take you to Kenya, where people living in areas of the country at risk of flooding or landslides will be asked to evacuate today, the country's president has said. Weeks of flooding have devastated large swathes of the country, with at least 170 people killed. And the Kenyan Weather Agency is warning heavy rains will continue until next week in many parts of the country. This was the Kenyan president, William Ruto, speaking to the BBC about his government's response.
We are going to make sure that we deploy every resource that is within our reach to make sure that we take care of this situation, even as we see the next steps. If it gets to a level where it becomes absolutely necessary for us to declare a national disaster, then those steps will be carried out.
As you'll have been hearing across the World Service, the human impact has already been extraordinary. The business impact could be likewise. Kenya is a major exporter, for example, of agricultural goods, everything from vegetables to coffee, and is one of the world's largest exporters of cut flowers. One of the country's oldest exporters is Sunripe Kenya, with decades of experience exporting vegetables and flowers across the country, the continent and the world. Its managing director is Hasit Shah.
So the situation has been with extreme rain in and around Nairobi and its environs in about a 90 to 100 kilometre radius. And the bigger impact is Nairobi and north of Nairobi. We've had some rain in the Rift Valley towards Naivasha and Nakuru. And it's been very different rain, where it starts in the evening and runs all the way through morning and quite intense.
And the impact then so far, from what you can see, to your growing area?
Because the rain's coming every evening, the daytime it dries out a bit, but the soils are waterlogged, so it's very difficult to send tractors in to prepare the fields and to plant. It's very difficult to harvest. And the crop that's in the ground also struggling because of the high water content.
And this is a key time of year, right?
It's having an impact because we're not able to supply orders in full at the moment. And then we're also not able to plant every week. So this will have an impact for us for the next 8 to 12 weeks.
Have you got any kind of assessment of the time frame and how long it's going to take to sort of recover, I guess?
The predictions from the Met Station are we will have rains for another 10 days and then they will slightly tail off. But all of May, June, July, the rains will still continue.
And I don't want to be a prophet of doom, but the pattern generally has been, right, that has then been followed by a period of drought as well. How difficult has the agriculture sector full stop been in Kenya in the past few years?
So let's just go back a bit further than that, because during COVID, we had no flights and there were market lockdowns. So everyone struggled for 2.5 years there. And then we went into a series of 5 seasons of no rain. So it was very dry. And now we've got too much rain. So literally 4 years of very difficult period. And in Kenya, we don't have support, nor do we have insurance available. So every grower is struggling.
How much danger is the industry in?
It's difficult. The long-term food security crops are okay because the wheat and the maize will grow through the rains and we'll harvest in August, September. So that's okay. But the cash crops that we do, the tomatoes, the onions for the local markets and the export crops, the flowers and the veg, will struggle through the summer.
And presumably those that do get through could expect more expensive prices where you export those goods to, I'm guessing, at the other end.
Obviously, because of lower yields, our cost per kilo does go up. But unfortunately, the markets will not pay a higher price. So it'll take us longer to recover.
So you'll have to take that hit financially?
Yes.
This has already been impacted as well, you were saying, by what's been going on in terms of disruption to international shipping through the Red Sea as well. So a problem on a problem.
Yes. Yeah, so over the last 5 years, we've been really developing sea freight exports of flowers. We've also worked out how to ship some of the veggies by sea and then, of course, our avocados. So to get to Europe, we ship through the Red Sea. And that has all really slowed down or stopped because we have to go now around South Africa. And that adds another 14 to 20 days. So that's not practical and viable for shelf life for what we do.
You talked about, I guess, sort of taking that hit. I'm assuming you're a business that's big enough to do that. I'm sure there are others smaller than yourselves who won't be able to do that. What do you think can be done, should be done? Is it government intervention needed, for example?
We definitely see a lot of production and farms closing down at the moment. The government will obviously have to somehow find ways to support the business. But again, we don't have subsidies in Kenya. So the private sector will come together. We will find new markets and we will have to find ways to work with growers and exporters to be able to just manage the situation over the next 12 months.
That's Hasit Shah there of Sunripe Kenya speaking to us from Nairobi.
Up there, you have to be quick to make decisions because it's not a natural environment for survival.
Five incredible women.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
I risked my life many times.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
I had to finish it, accomplish it.
Search for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Let's take you to India, where the fishing is a pretty significant industry. About 28 million people rely on it for their livelihoods. And as the Indian election campaign continues, the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has stirred up controversy by criticising an opposition leader for eating fish during a 9-day Hindu festival. Mr. Modi and the ruling party, the BJP, have been campaigning hard in the coastal state of Kerala, where our correspondent Samira Hussain is. Samira, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
I'm happy to be here.
It sounds pretty lively behind you.
Yeah, it is. You know, I've actually spent most of the day by this fishing village. And in front of me, I see about a dozen women that are selling different kinds of fish, big fish, little fish. I've seen some pretty massive fish coming out of the sea. And as you rightly pointed out, so much of this state's economy depends on fishing in some way or another.
Right, yeah. And tell us about some of the people that you've met, some of their concerns, I suppose, in the election.
Right, though, I have been speaking with quite a few fishermen, you know, to talk about the elections and just how things have been going for them. And for so many, because they feel such a massive squeeze when it comes to how much effort they have to put in to actually go and fish, and then how much money they make in return, they feel really very squeezed. And so that has been the most pressing concern over the years for some of these fishermen who have been at this job for 30 years. They've seen a marked change in terms of how much they actually are able to get, and that has made it really difficult for them to make ends meet.
And is that squeeze, is that why they took such offense to this criticism of an opposition politician eating fish, that they feel like they're sort of not being seen already, and that was sort of a statement of that?
Well, actually, to be clear, you know, when I asked a few people about that here, in fact, it didn't even register. I mean, I had one man say to me, you know, oh, well, he can say whatever he wants, because for him, it's his daily livelihood that is at stake. The fact that they can spend hours on end trying to, you know, pull fish out from the sea, and by the time they sell it and they divide the earnings, they've only made a few dollars in a day. And because it varies from day to day and week to week, sometimes that's the amount of money that they're going to have it will have to last them for a few weeks.
And Samira, the election roadshow rolls on. You're certainly getting the miles in.
Indeed. You know, I was really fortunate to be able to actually speak to some women in Bihar in the north, and they had just such an incredible outlook in terms of, you know, what is it that they want. And, you know, the question being posed to them was really about representation, that there aren't a lot of women being represented in parliament here. And they were just eloquent about speaking about how important it was to have that representation.
Well, we can certainly hear the sounds if we can't even see the sights of the Indian election there. Thanks so much to Samira Hussain, our correspondent, speaking to us from the coastal village of coastal state of Kerala there. Let's turn back to Russ Mould from the British investment platform AJ Bell. And Russ, a lot going on in the financial markets today. Something we've talked about a lot has been commodity prices and a couple of interesting companies, stocks and shares today, telling us something about those commodity prices.
So you look at the screen and you look, oh, what are the best performing shares in Europe today? And it's two Swiss companies, Barry Callebaut and Lindt, and they both make chocolate. So then you think, OK, why is that? And then you look, oh, the cocoa price, which trebled between January and April from $4,000 to $12,000 a tonne, has suddenly collapsed and it's gone back to around $9,000 a tonne. Still very high, but not as bad as it was. Why? Well, the Côte d'Ivoire, one of the big suppliers, is now compensating shippers because farmers have been losing money and have been charging higher prices. The shippers have been losing money. So they're trying to keep supply going. And also, the American Intercontinental Exchange is demanding more money from financial players who want to play in the futures market to try and quell speculation. So some of the heat has come out. Some of the melt up in the cocoa price has begun to calm down.
Yeah, interesting. That's an interesting trend to keep following. Something that we've followed intently, and the market is just, it's the only thing really that it's watching this week, right, is the decision later on our time here in Europe, a little bit lunchtime in the United States from the Federal Reserve, and about what they choose to do, the central bank there, around their key borrowing rate, that interest rate, just sort of set the table for this.
5.5%, no change expected. Quantitative tightening programme, further monetary tightening expected at a very gentle rate. The issue is, do Mr Powell and his colleagues lay the groundwork for interest rate cuts later in the year? If we'd have been talking in January, financial markets would have been pricing in 6 interest rate cuts, the first in March. Well, that's proven to be completely wrong. Now we're looking for 2 interest rate cuts this year, first in September. So that'll be the key benchmark for the comments.
And that is having lots of sort of unintended, perhaps unexpected consequences, particularly around countries' currencies. And we're going to look at one now. If you were with us earlier in the week, of course, you know that Japan has been battling with a very volatile value of its currency, the yen. The BBC's Japan correspondent, Shima Halil in Tokyo, tell us a bit more about the impact that's having there.
I think they're definitely feeling it. And remember, the cost of living crisis has been felt all across the world. But remember, Japan is a country where prices have been stable for a while and salaries have been stable or stagnant for a while. And so for them to feel that spike, to feel any kind of increase, is quite stark for your average Japanese household. I think these are rates of falling that we have seen in the 1990s, that kind of slump with the yen. And if you look at the chatter, for example, on social media, on Reddit, what you'll see is people saying, listen, my spending has spiked or my spending has increased, but my spending habits haven't changed. And I remember when I first moved here, for example, one big point of pride is that the price of a McDonald's burger didn't change for years and years and years. And when it did change, everybody was talking about it. So any change in prices in the day-to-day supermarket items is felt.
Yeah, you've given a really good illustration of the kind of double-edged sword in cliched terms of what's going on in terms of ordinary people. For the wider economy, too, it has that two sides to it, doesn't it? Japan, for example, imports a lot of the food that it uses, a lot of the energy that it uses. Are those costs being passed on to people?
Yes. And I can tell you, again, one of the things that people are telling me, and certainly I'm feeling it, is that you're feeling that difference when you go pay your energy bill, for example. It is incremental. It is not a huge spike, but you do feel that your bills are building up. Salaries have been stagnant for a while. And I think this is where you're feeling the pinch.
On the other side of it, though, that people will know the big Japanese brands all around the world, won't they? The Sonys, the Nintendos, the Panasonics, a great exporting nation, too. And in that sense, the price might look the same to, say, someone in the US buying one of these products, but actually the money coming back to those companies will be more with what's happening now.
Yeah, if I had a dollar every time my friends or my family said, could you buy this and this for us from Japan now? Could you buy? Because it's just, it works out much cheaper. And I think a family of tourists, which have really, really increased in number. And I was just looking at numbers, for example, from the Japanese National Tourism Organization. I think it was 3 million in March alone. And it just tells you, not only is it back because essentially we're post-COVID, but also the fact that the dollars here, the tourism dollars, travel much, much further. And I think, yes, that's good news for businesses, definitely good news for exporters. But One thing that stood out for me, Will, watching this in terms of trends, is that when you travel the other way, it's the exact opposite. We're in Golden Week now, for example, which is a series of public holidays, and people normally take like a week or 10 days and travel. Speaking to colleagues in our office, for example, watching Japanese TV, they were running some commentary on the fact that Japanese families who still want to go, because again, it's their first chance after COVID, they're finding that their trips are very, very different because the yen doesn't do for them what it used to do.
The BBC's correspondent in Tokyo there, Shaima Halil. Russ, just explain that. Interest rate decisions in the US. Why does that affect other countries' currencies?
The key issue here is what's known as the spread, the gap, the interest rate differential between two countries. If I can get 5.5% in American dollars against 0.1% in yen, where am I going to put my money to get a better return? Simple. I'm going to buy dollars and I'm going to sell yen. What markets also look for, though, is the rate of change in that differential. And they've been expecting that gap to close this year. Faster Japanese rate increases, faster Fed rate cuts, and they haven't had either. So the spread has stayed bigger than expected. That's why the dollar's still going up.
Well, let's hear a little bit more about some of the impact, some of those consequences, unintended or intended or otherwise. George Han is from the Hans Group, which runs hospitality businesses, including golf courses, wine bars in Tokyo, and a site for posh camping, or glamping, as it's certainly known here in the UK, in Kawaguchiko, close to the foothills of Mount Fuji.
Usually I hate gloating, but I describe it that we have one of the finest view of the mountain Fuji. We are at the bottom of the mountain. We are right inside in the forest of Kawaguchiko. When you visit our establishment, you are surrounded by the very thick and wild nature of Japanese forest, where you experience the animals like flying squirrels. You can see deers.
Sounds yes. Idyllic, and I'm sure I can hear a lot of listeners already there. Attention perhaps drifting a little bit at work today, thinking of a holiday where you are.
Yes.
A lot of people have been doing just that in Japan in the past few years, haven't they? Because of exactly what we're talking about. It's been a lot cheaper, certainly if you're a visitor from the United States, for example, to come
exactly.
And visit Japan because of what's been happening with the yen currency. Have you seen that?
A year ago, Japan government uplifted the restrictions of coming inside the country without the COVID test and without issuing any visa. So almost a year ago, the tourists visiting us just boomed. Lately, I keep hearing more and more that people from abroad are way more happy with the current situation of yen. But to be honest, I haven't seen as a main reason to visit Japan. I feel that this idea that everybody wants to visit Japan has been around almost a year, 2 years.
Right. So if you're not seeing necessarily a big benefit from the weakening of the yen, are you seeing challenges in terms of your costs? Are things getting anything more expensive that perhaps you import, that kind of thing?
Yes, of course, we face this sort of small challenges, but in the Japanese mentality is to not get panicked or depressed.
Can you give us some examples? What kind of things?
Mostly about the daily charges like electricity or the goods, because as a company, we also purchase things from abroad. Right now, it's a bit more difficult.
And in terms of measures, other measures, have you had to look at your own prices of what you're charging your visitors?
About that, we still stick to our main schedule. I mean, as we saw since the last year, Japan is more free to be visited. We have created almost a 3 years plan how we are going to follow about our prices to make it more attractive for people abroad, also for the locals.
George Han of the Han Group speaking to us from Kawaguchiko, close to Mount Fuji. Russ, how much of what we've heard is a yen issue and how much of it actually is about the strength of the US dollar?
Some of it is definitely down to the yen. They've had zero interest rates for nearly 20 years. They've been printing, the Bank of Japan has been printing money through quantitative and qualitative easing for just as long. And again, it's like Pakistan. There's no free money. There's ultimately a cost here. And yes, the West has given out free money during COVID and post-financial crisis. And the cost is either higher interest rates, higher inflation, or a lower currency. And by choice or not, Japan's gone down the lower currency route.
And we heard some of the impacts that people were sort of feeling already positive for that gentleman running a tourism business, in theory, in terms of make it cheaper for visitors and more attractive for visitors. But we are seeing more consequences from a strong dollar far beyond Japan as well, right?
It's traditionally seen as bad for emerging market economies, because particularly if they borrowed in debt. It's traditionally seen as bad for current commodity demand because they're priced in dollars, so it makes them more expensive for non-dollar countries. and it's traditionally seen as disinflationary or deflationary and slowing for the world economy because the dollar is the world's reserve currency and it's more expensive. The Federal Reserve has to think about this, but its main consideration is domestic.
Well, there you go. There's your primer for later on, our second edition of World Business Report, and of course, business matters. Later on the World Service with Roger Hearing, do tune in to find out all about that there. But thanks so much to Russ Mould, and thanks to you for listening to World Business Report.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition, and they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment.
Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.